Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 17, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the recent Supreme Court decision in State Farm Fire and Casualty Company versus U.S. X. Rel. Rigsby. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us Larry Ebner, who is the founder of Capital Appellate Advocacy. I will turn it over to Mr. Ebner to get us started. After his opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer, so please be thinking of questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Larry. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Nate, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to divide my initial remarks into four parts. First, I'm going to provide some general background on the False Claims Act QTAM provisions. I will then discuss the background of the State Farm case. I will, after that, summarize the Supreme Court's unanimous opinion in the case, and finally provide some commentary of my own on the opinion. So let's begin with False Claims Act QTAM background. The False Claims Act creates civil liability for knowingly submitting to the federal government a false or fraudulent claim for payment or approval, or a false record or statement that is material to a false or fraudulent claim. The QTAM provisions, which are set forth at 31 U.S. Code Section 3730, allow private party whistleblowers, known as relators, to file a False Claims Act action, quote, for and quote, in the name of the United States. That's why when you see the captions of these cases, it's United States X. Rel. Rigsby. The Rigsbys are the relators in the State Farm case. The goal of the QTAM provisions, which were modernized in 1986, is to augment the Department of Justice's limited resources by encouraging private enforcement suits for fraud against the government. If a QTAM suit is successful, a QTAM defendant can be liable for treble damages, plus hefty civil penalties, plus attorney fees and costs. The United States, through the Justice Department, can intervene at any time and take over primary responsibility for pursuing a QTAM suit. What I'd like to emphasize is that QTAM litigation can be very lucrative for relators and their counsel. By statute, and this is an incentive for encouraging private enforcement suits, by statute, if the government intervenes, a district court can award the relator between 15 and 25% of the proceeds or settlement. If the government declines to intervene, which is usually the case, a district court can award the relator between 25 and 30% of the proceeds or settlement. And relators' attorneys, who almost always are contingency fee counsel, typically collect between 30 and 50% of the relator's recovery. And I think that probably explains the explosive growth of what we call the QTAM bar, which is probably second only to the class action bar in terms of creativity and aggressiveness in suing corporations in the United States. According to Justice Department statistics, total QTAM judgments and settlements between 1987 and 2015 were over $33 billion. There's tremendous pressure on defendants to settle QTAM suits prior to trial and avoid both the financial and reputational risks of being held liable for defrauding the United States government. And what that means, because of the pressure to settle, what that means is that relators and their counsel can collect huge bounties without ever having to prove fraud to a court, and sometimes without even having to meet the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 9B fraud pleading requirements, which, as you know, are quite stringent. Let me give you a few more key facts by way of background. The yearly number of QI-TAM suits has more than tripled during the past 15 to 20 years. Since 1987, more than 10,000 QI-TAM suits have been filed, and more than 700 of them were filed just during 2016. The key targets of QI-TAM relators and their counsel are the healthcare industry, government contractors, federal grant recipients, and virtually any company or organization that gets paid or reimbursed by the federal government. Another key fact to keep in mind is that following investigation of a relator's allegations, the Justice Department intervenes in only about 25% of QI-TAM suits. And statistics show that judgments and settlements are much higher when the Justice Department does intervene. Since 1987, judgments and settlements have been $31 billion in intervened QI-TAM suits versus only $2 billion when the government does not intervene. And similarly, relator awards are much higher when the government intervenes. A total over the years of $5 billion when the government intervenes versus only a little more than $500,000 when the government does not intervene. Last year, 2016, was a banner year for QI-TAM suits. The government recovered almost $3 billion in QI-TAM settlements and judgments, and of that, $519 million went to relators and their counsel. Now, with that background on QI-TAM litigation, not only the statutory scheme in general, but also the aggressiveness with which these suits are pursued, let me talk about the State Farm case. The State Farm case involved the QI-TAM file under seal provision, which Congress added to the False Claims Act in 1986 as part of reform legislation, which, as I said, was intended to encourage more QI-TAM suits to supplement the government's own False Claims Act efforts. The seal provision, which is at Section 3730B2, states that, and I'm reading, a copy of the complaint and written disclosure of substantially all material evidence and information the relator possesses shall be served on the government. The complaint shall be filed in camera and shall remain under seal for at least 60 days and shall not be served on the defendant until the court so orders. As a practical matter, the QI-TAM seal provision gives the Justice Department an opportunity to investigate a relator's allegations and decide whether to intervene. According to the Justice Department, Congress added the seal requirement at its request and solely for the Justice Department's benefit in order to prevent tipping off an unknowing QI-TAM defendant about a pending federal criminal fraud investigation, which sometimes go hand in hand with civil QI-TAM litigation. They wanted to avoid tipping off a defendant, thereby enabling the defendant to try to thwart or evade the government's investigation. And as a practical matter, the Justice Department can and often does request multiple time extensions beyond that initial 60-day seal period to conduct its investigation, often in conjunction with affected federal departments and agencies that prepare reports. So the issue, the specific issue in the State Farm case, was whether a seal violation by a relator or her counsel requires automatic dismissal of the relator's QI-TAM suit. And when you look at the Supreme Court's opinion, which I'll discuss in detail in a few moments, I think that the Supreme Court misstated the issue by asking whether, quote, any and all violations of the seal requirement mandate dismissal. Specifically, the State Farm relators were insurance claim adjusters. They worked for a company hired by State Farm to adjust Hurricane Katrina-related property damage claims. The claims at issue arose under federal government-backed insurance policies that covered flooded damage and general homeowner insurance policies that covered wind damage. The gravamen of the relator's complaint was that State Farm instructed the adjusters to misclassify wind damage as flood damage in order to shift the ultimate insurance obligation to the federal government. They filed their QTAM suit in camera in April 2006 in the Mississippi Federal District Court, and as required by the statute, served the Justice Department with their complaint and with a written factual disclosure under seal. In January 2007, the district court partially lifted the seal to allow disclosure of the suit to an Alabama district court in a tangentially related matter. And in August 2007, the district court fully lifted the seal. In January 2008, after investigating the relator's fraud allegations against State Farm, declined to intervene in the case, leaving it to the relators themselves and their counsel. Now, it's beyond dispute that prior to lifting of the full seal, the relator's counsel deliberately disclosed the suit and its allegations to a number of national media organizations, to a member of Congress, and to a public relations firm. As a result, in January 2011, State Farm moved to dismiss the suit on the ground that the seal had been violated deliberately. The district court denied the motion to dismiss based on the Ninth Circuit balancing test involving three factors: the harm to the government, the severity of the violations, and the evidence of bad faith. That was the United States ex rel Lujan versus Hughes Aircraft case, a 1995 Ninth Circuit decision. Judgment was rendered after State Farm in the district court following a bellwether trial involving one home. The Fifth Circuit, utilizing the same three Lujan factors, affirmed the district court's denial of dismissal of the suit. The Fifth Circuit held that the Justice Department had not been harmed because the violations came after partial lifting of the seal, that the violation was not as severe as failing to file the suit at all under seal, and that the violation was committed by the relator's counsel, not by the relators themselves. After inviting the views of the Solicitor General, who opposed an automatic dismissal rule for QTAM seal violations, the Supreme Court granted certiorari. Oral argument was held on November 1st, 2016, and if you look at the Federalist Society page announcing this teleforum, you can see a link to my post-hearing analysis of that hearing, as well as to the government's merit stage amicus brief. On December 6, 2016, a unanimous eight-member court issued its opinion, authored by Justice Kennedy. The court held that dismissal for QTAM seal violations is not mandatory, but instead should be left to the discretion of a district court in each case. And the court further held that the district court did not abuse its discretion here in the State Farm case, despite the relator counsel's flagrant violations of the seal requirement. The court's analysis of the mandatory dismissal issue was concise, and let me give you a quick summary of it. The court said that the False Claims Act does not enact so harsh a rule, that although the seal requirement is a mandatory rule, the statute says nothing about a remedy for violation of that rule, and that if Congress had intended dismissal for a seal violation, it knew how to say so and would have said so in the statute. The opinion further says that because the seal requirement was intended to protect the government's interests, it would make little sense to adopt a rigid interpretation that prejudices the government by depriving it of needed assistance from private parties. And the court noted that the Solicitor General agreed. In fact, the Solicitor General argued that an automatic dismissal rule would undermine the government's interests and provide a defendant with a windfall. Here's a quote from the government's amicus brief, quote, "An automatic dismissal rule would exacerbate the government's injury, depriving the government of the potential recovery from the relator's suit, forcing the government either to devote resources to pursuing the claim itself or to allow possible fraud to go unredressed." The opinion indicates that even though every SEAL violation does not mandate dismissal, that sanction remains a possible form of relief, and that that question, the question of whether it should be dismissal or what sanctions should be imposed for SEAL violation, should be left to the district court's sound discretion. The court concluded its opinion by stating that although the Lujan factors, quote, appear to be appropriate, these and other relevant considerations can be discussed in the course of later cases. So the court did not even squarely adopt the Lujan three-factor test. Let me offer some comments, some of my own comments and observations about this opinion. First, I believe that the court's holding undermines rather than reinforces the integrity of the QI-TAM scheme, including specifically the SEAL provision. It undermines the Justice Department's QI-TAM gatekeeper function by sending the wrong message to relators and to the QI-TAM bar. It basically, I think, promotes gaming the system, gaming the QI-TAM system, such as by using public disclosure to short-circuit the government's investigation and to pressure a defendant to settle before the Justice Department decides whether the relator's allegations warrant intervention. And remember what I said earlier. The government intervenes in only about 25% of the cases. So, when the government does not intervene, relator recoveries are much lower than in the unusual circumstance where the government does intervene. So being able to pressure a defendant into settling a QI-TAM suit before the government decides whether to intervene very well may work in the favor of the relators and their counsel. And I think that it also short-circuits the Justice Department's ability to settle directly with the defendant, even if the relator objects. And all that by using public disclosure, albeit in violation of the SEAL requirement, as a pressure tactic, because the defendant's going to want to mitigate financial and reputational harm flowing from publicity surrounding the fraud against the government allegations. Another observation about the opinion is that it fails to distinguish between negligent SEAL violations, for example, if there's been an inadvertent or de minimis disclosure or where a relator's attorney doesn't even know about the SEAL requirement, and a deliberate and egregious SEAL violation by an unscrupulous attorney or relator, as in the State Farm case. At the hearing in the State Farm case, Justice Alito commented that it would be difficult to imagine a worse example of a bad faith SEAL violation. Nonetheless, the government tried to downplay the deliberate SEAL violation in this case, calling it minor compared to not filing a QI-TAM suit under SEAL at all. In my opinion, the government has this exactly backwards. I think that a deliberate SEAL violation, as in the State Farm case, is far worse than an inexperienced attorney negligently failing to file a QI-TAM suit under SEAL. Another observation is that the opinion is disappointingly narrow because it does not squarely articulate the standards that lower courts should utilize in determining whether dismissal or some other sanction should be imposed for a QI-TAM SEAL violation. It does not resolve the inter-circuit split of authority that led to the granting of certiorari in the first place. And I think most importantly, the opinion provides no guidance on how to assess or weigh the actual harm or potential harm to the government resulting from a SEAL violation. As you recall, the first factor in the Lujan test is the harm to the government. But in cases where the government does not intervene, which is a case in 75% of QI-TAM suits, how can a district court determine whether the Justice Department was harmed by a SEAL violation? It's unlikely the government is going to talk about its confidential investigation or its reasons for not intervening. In this case, the government said it wasn't harmed, but it had been invited by the Supreme Court to file an amicus brief expressing its views. If the government doesn't intervene, it's going to be left to conjecture on the part of the parties in the district court to what extent, if any, or how seriously the government was harmed. And yet that's the first factor that the Supreme Court in this opinion said would be appropriate for consideration in deciding what sanction, including dismissal, should be imposed. The opinion does acknowledge that the petitioner and its amici in this case place great emphasis on the reputational harm that False Claims Act defendants may suffer when the SEAL requirement is violated. And in fact, I had the privilege of submitting an amicus brief for DRI, the Voice of the Defense Bar, and in our brief, we emphasized that the SEAL requirement is not just to protect the government's interests, but also to protect the interests of the unknowing defendant, who is the subject of unproven fraud allegations in a complaint that's supposed to be maintained under seal while the government investigates and decides whether the allegations have enough merit to warrant Justice Department intervention. The court, in its opinion in State Farm, seems to have left the door open to considering defendants' reputational harm as a factor that the district court can utilize in determining what sanction to impose. But again, there's no indication in the opinion how much weight to give that factor. As I argued in the amicus brief that I submitted, a defendant's reputation can be seriously, if not irreparably, harmed by mere allegations of fraud against the government. Remember, this isn't just a breach of contract situation. This is an accusation of defrauding the United States government. And it can result, for example, in loss of eligibility to bid on government contracts or to participate in government programs such as Medicare or to qualify for federal grants. And as I think I mentioned earlier, the Solicitor General's amicus brief repeatedly asserted that the SEAL requirement was not designed to protect the defendant's reputation, but just to protect the government's investigatory interests and only those interests. But there is contrary legislative history. The Senate report that the opinion cites in a number of places states explicitly that sealing the initial private civil false claims complaint protects both the government and the defendant's interests without harming those of the private relator. And I guess my final observation before we open it up for questions is that the opinion seems to criticize the petitioner petitioner, in other words, State Farm, in this case, for not asking the district court to impose an alternative remedy in the event that its motion to dismiss was denied. So, if nothing else, there is some practical advice that flows out of this opinion, which is that if you are representing a defendant in a QI-TAM suit and there is a SEAL violation, by all means seek dismissal for the SEAL violation, but request in the alternative other remedies, perhaps a percentage reduction in the relator's award, if there is an award, or attorney discipline, as an alternative to dismissal if the court feels that dismissal is not warranted. So, Nate, that concludes my overview and summary and comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good, Larry. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Larry, one of the questions I had, I think you indicated that you felt this decision was disappointingly narrow. Do you think that's a function of something going on with the Roberts Court, that they're looking in these cases while they only have eight justices to have narrow decisions and find unanimous ground where they can, or they're just simply pushing it back to lower courts and waiting for a ninth justice to join them?
I think there's probably an element of being as narrow as possible until the full complement of justices is on the court, because when you look at the language in the opinion about how the Lujan factors may be appropriate, but we'll leave that for another day, there really isn't any reason why the court couldn't have squarely endorsed those factors to give guidance to the lower courts. Now, it is true that that seal violations occur in a lot of other contexts, and there is case law on factors to be considered there, but the QI-TAM provisions are quite unique, and the suit is being brought by private relators, but for and in the name of the United States. So there's a lot of gravity in just the filing of the suit. And to think that the Supreme Court denied an automatic dismissal rule and just said that even in the most egregious of circumstances, we'll just leave it up to a district court to decide what sanction, if any, to impose, is quite disappointing.
Okay, very good. We currently have one person waiting in line to ask a question. If you would like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. One programming note that is that our next telephone conference call will be scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. That call will discuss the Supreme Court's oral arguments in Lee v. Tam. That call will feature Dwayne Sam, who's an associate at Wiley Rain, LLP, and Megan L. Brown, who's a partner at Wiley Rain. Let's go to our first question, audience question of the day.
I'd like to get a couple of clarifications about this. When the suit was filed, did they make a public announcement to the press that they had filed the suit, the plaintiff?
No.
It could have been remedied by the court having a procedure where when they see such a QI-TAM suit, to automatically place it under seal. Because it seems to me that one of the things they're trying to do is not to disclose this to the defendant in case there is an investigation going on. Is that correct?
Well, not quite, because as the court points out in its opinion, the filing of a QI-TAM suit under seal is mandatory.
Okay, so if filed and it's not mandatory, shouldn't the courts catch that and make it sealed?
In other words, if for example, a QI-TAM relator's attorney files it without
sealing it,
because he or she's not familiar with the requirement.
Right. And so the court could easily, in its computerized filing procedures, say, oh, this is a QI-TAM action for a whistleblower. Let's place this under seal, notify the attorney that he's got to keep quiet about it, and not tell the defendant in case there's an investigation going on.
Right. And under those circumstances, where there is an inadvertent violation of the seal requirement, that may be an appropriate remedy. And that's why during my remarks I said that I'm not sure that the court properly articulated the question presented by this case, because the question presented, articulated in the opinion, is whether any and all seal violations should result in automatic dismissal.
Now,
I think more accurately, the question presented here is whether a deliberate bad faith seal violation should warrant automatic dismissal.
And this thing was deliberate.
No question that it was deliberate, and that's explained in the court's opinion. And the allegations were disclosed to a number of national news media. Member of Congress, etc.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems that happens when you have a whistleblower suit, let's say you've got one of the magnitude of Snowden, and he wants to tell the world about this. If he went through the usual route of filing suit, he would be in jail today. He wouldn't be in Russia. I mean, because the forces arrayed against him with our present president, anti-whistleblower president, who filed more espionage actions against the whistleblowers than any other president in history. You really don't want to be, in many circumstances, you don't want to be going up against the powers that be. In any kind of a whistleblower suit. So to make it harder for him to, I mean, if you don't reveal this to the press right away, simultaneously, you're opening yourself up to being shipped off to some incommunicado situation under the Espionage Act.
Well, that may be true in that context, but the key TAM provisions are a unique context because the relator is filing the suit literally in the name of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you probably just articulated a good rationale for the under seal requirement to allow the Justice Department to conduct its civil investigation and possibly also a parallel criminal investigation without disclosing the existence of the suit to the defendant. The problem here is a deliberate violation of the seal requirement that then can be used as a pressure tactic to force a settlement, which ultimately does have to be approved by the court, by the way, but to force a settlement in order to allow the defendant to try to mitigate the harm flowing from publicity where the allegations are unsubstantiated. Now, in this case, the defendant went to trial and lost the bellwether trial after having its motion to dismiss denied. But there's tremendous pressure to settle these because of reputational harm. And I believe the Supreme Court gave short shrift to that factor.
Is it also a requirement that the Justice Department be notified by the plaintiff and served at the same time as the case is filed under seal?
That's correct.
And the under seal, does that eliminate the requirement to file to serve the defendant when you file this thing in case
right.
there's
so right.
so
well,
so the proper
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The proper procedure is to file this under seal, send a copy to the Justice Department, and then wait for the court to tell you what to do next.
Right. The statute says the complaint shall be filed in camera, shall remain under seal for at least 60 days, and shall not be served on the defendant until the court so orders.
Uh-huh.
As I mentioned, the government often requires far more than 60 days to conduct its investigation.
So they'll go back to the judge and say, we want an extension.
Right. Sometimes it takes months and months or years
mm-hmm.
before the government decides whether to intervene. And mm-hmm. sometimes, as in this case, the seal is lifted before the government makes its decision.
The seal is lifted by the court before the
right.
government makes it, because otherwise the government could drag its feet forever. Presume that a Justice Department official is part of the cover-up or whatever the problem is going on, or he's under pressure by an administration that doesn't want this information. Let's say the FDA has been insulating Monsanto from the damages that that Roundup is doing, and the FDA is the problem, and the whistleblower is trying to show collusion between the FDA and Monsanto. This kind of a KTOM suit might be appropriate there.
Well, I'm not going to, you know,
I don't think there is such a suit going on.
Speculative situation, but I really think that it's just to give the Justice Department enough time to investigate, and it's as simple as that. But I do think there's a certain balancing that if the government takes too long, the court also wants to protect the statutory rights of the relator pursuing the litigation, and the government can, you know, decide to intervene later after the suit proceeds. And also, the government can decide to settle the case out from under the relator, sometimes in terms that the relator doesn't like.
Yeah, so the relator's not collecting the damages from this thing. He's only collecting the KTOM bounty.
Well, the relator collects a share of the treble damages.
Yeah.
And judgment, which also can include civil penalties.
Okay. Well, that's I guess that explains that answers my questions. We could take the next questioner if there is one.
Thank you very much, caller. If you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Larry, based on your presentation, is it your impression that going forward, we're going to see more instances of relators deliberately violating the seal requirements?
Well, I certainly hope not. I should add that seal violations are relatively rare. But now we have a situation where the Supreme Court has said that you can violate the seal in the worst possible way, maybe in the most harmful possible way to both the government and a defendant, and the case still might go forward, particularly if the government wants it to go forward. So what impact that might have on counsel who represent relators remains to be seen. I don't want to go so far as to say that it's going to encourage seal violations, but I do think it sends a message to the KTAM bar and to relators, some of whom are professional relators, that sometimes disclosure possibly can be used as a pressure tactic and result in a settlement without the case being dismissed. So I think time will tell what impact this will have. I do think that with this deferential standard to district courts, the abuse of discretion standard, it's going to be difficult to obtain appellate review of a denial to dismiss a KTAM suit for a seal violation, and similarly difficult to obtain meaningful appellate review of other sanctions that might be imposed, because abuse of discretion is such a deferential standard to district court judges. So I think it may be a long time until we see the Supreme Court dealing with this issue again, if ever.
Well, very good. That's very interesting. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see the full impact of this decision. Currently, the audience question line is wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Another just reminder to our audience to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. And, of course, available there are our podcasts of previously recorded calls. Larry, I'll issue one last final call for questions. I don't see any at this time. Are there any concluding additional remarks or concluding remarks you'd like to offer our audience?
Only to heed the practical advice that comes out of the opinion, which is to, if you're involved in defending a QI-TAM defendant and there has been a sealed violation, seek an appropriate sanction, including possibly dismissal of the suit. The State Farm opinion certainly does not rule that out.
Okay, very good. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Larry Ebner for speaking with us today. We appreciate your time and expertise. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.